The following is a paid advertisement of St. Anthony Hospital Orthopedics. References to any specific product, services, or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by St. Anthony Hospital, Carroll Broadcasting, or its advertisers. The views expressed by the host or guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Welcome to the St. Anthony Hospital Orthopedic Show with Dr. Richard Godding. Dr. Godding specializes in joint preservation, reconstruction, and replacement surgery, and brings over 25 years of orthopedic excellence to St. Anthony Hospital and to the Carroll area. For more information about Dr. Godding, his practice, or St. Anthony Orthopedics, go to stanthonyhospital.org or make an appointment by calling 712-794-5536.
Good Sunday morning, Iowa. It's Dr. Rick Godding. Thank you once again for choosing to spend a little time here with me. So, last weekend, I spent the better part of the weekend in my yard. And we have a fair hill in the yard. And on Sunday, I had three of my oldest daughter's friends, boys, come over and help me in the yard. And of course, you know, I wasn't going to let them outwork me. So I did a lot, and I had already spent a lot of hours in the yard already on the day, and we were hauling these bags of mulch, which, quite fortuitously, there had been rain, so the mulch bags, instead of weighing 5 or 8 pounds, weighed 20 pounds, 30 pounds each. And so we were carrying those up the hill. We carried quite a few of them up the hill, among the other things that we did. But I wasn't going to let them beat me. So I'm sure I was more sore today than they are, but still I was hustling. But it's one of those things. It was nice because I remember being that age, and when somebody would, well, what I did when I was that age, a lot of the time in the summer, I did lawn mowing and things like that. But we used to haul hay, and we used to get 10 cents a bale, I remember. And we'd go out there. I was a city kid, but we had a place that my grandpa had out by the lake, which was just a plot of land. And then he parked a camping trailer out there, and we would go out there. Had good times with Grandpa. Grandpa, that was my grandpa, my mom's stepdad. So I had both my mom's dad and stepdad in my life, so that was cool. But this was Grandpa Norris, and he was a Boy Scout when he was young, and he was actually on a minesweeper in World War II, so he had just all kinds of cool life experiences and stories. And we used to go out there, and he would take just me out there sometimes, and we would camp, and we'd have a little fire, and we would eat beans out of a can. It was just the coolest thing. But so we kind of met neighbors around there, and some of them were farmers, and so they had hay to bale. So I would get up. It was just a real adventure for, you know, I started that when I was 14, I think, or 13. And I would go, and we'd get in the back of this truck, like a flatbed with wooden side panels, and we would follow behind the combine. I don't know if you call it a combine. It was a baler. It basically would harvest and then bale the hay and spit the square block hay bales out the back, and then we would load them into the truck. And then we would make however many trips that it would take. There might have been two trucks, and I was in one of them. But it was, you know, we would sit there, and these guys were way older than me. I don't know how old they were. They seemed ancient. They might have been 30, you know. But, you know, way, way older than me. And I remember we would always eat bologna sandwiches with mustard. And then at the end of the day, we would climb up into the barn, and it would be so hot up there. And you'd have to use a bandana around your nose and mouth so you could breathe, and your eyes, you know, it was rough work, but 10 cents a bale. And sometimes we'd do 600-700 bales in a day, right? Because, I mean, you're just following right behind there. I think there's something like you could get 200 in the truck maybe, and I don't know if this math is right. Anyway, I remember getting like $70 for a long day's work, and thinking that was, I mean, we're talking, this was sun up to sundown work. And I remember thinking how great that was. And it's interesting because these boys came over and got more than that for working 3 hours, not nearly as hard as we did, but such is life, I guess. It was still good to, you know, they came over, they worked hard. They didn't work like a pro group, but I was out there with them the whole time, so I kind of kept them on track. But it was definitely, it was a good experience, and I'm probably going to have them back a few more times because, you know, I think it's good. It's good for the kids to go out there and do their own thing and get their own money. And it's, if you have a crew come to your house under somebody else, well, they're going to end up getting $60 an hour for each one of those workers or more because, you know, they have to pay them and then they have to do their whatever kind of insurance or whatever on them. And then they have to take, you know, their administrative. So then they have to pay for their trucks and their office and their secretaries and all that stuff out of that money that that person is making. So much more economical to get the young boys there and just get them going. And we positioned enough of these bags that I can do the rest of it all on my own without too much trouble. So it's definitely, it's that time of year, but it's always fun to get the young guys. My daughter came out and worked a little bit, and then she had to go to volleyball practice. And the weekend that you're listening to this, I will be on our last travel volleyball tournament of the year in Louisville, Kentucky. So 9 hours each way in the car, three hotel room nights, and just, it's a lot, this travel volleyball, but it's been good for them. You know, I talked about it a bunch. I mean, it's all good girls who are pretty much involved in families that are willing to drive 9 hours to Louisville for their kids. And, you know, you worry about them getting a little bit spoiled with this stuff. But on the other hand, I don't know. Parenting is more difficult, I think, now than it was when we were young because, you know, my mom, when I was 14, she just kind of, you know, let us do whatever we want. And even when we were little, you know, you'd go out and you'd play and mom would say, be home by dark. Didn't even really, where are you going to be? Well, probably at the park, but maybe at so-and-so's house, maybe not. No phones. We lived. But nowadays it's, you know, got these apps on the phone where you can see where your kid is and everything. I don't know. It's just, it's a different world. It's a very different world. It's a different life. And it's harder for the kids to get the lessons that we got just inherently in how we had to function. But there's a lot of good kids out there. I mean, there's sometimes you hear all the stuff and it's, you think, oh, well, the younger generations are, don't really want to work. I think the high school generation, you know, they don't know how to work like we knew how to work at that age as a generation. But I think they also see the couple of generations in front of them and are like, yeah, I don't know if I want to do that. So that's what I'm hoping, is that there's a rebound in the understanding that you need to work and it takes a long time. You know, you had a lot of these, you hear the Generation X and the Generation, I guess the Millennials, and a lot of them, you know, they want to come out of college and 3 years later have a six-figure job and be a vice president. They just don't understand that that's not how it works. And I'm hoping that that is coming back with the, as the financial reality of decades of fiscal mismanagement of this country are starting to come home to roost. But anyway, it was a good weekend. And again, we got to head out all the way to Louisville. And while they do have delicious meat in Louisville, that's I'd rather just stay home. And it's funny because the girls aren't enthused about it. The parents aren't enthused about it. Everybody's like, why are we going to Louisville? It's the big tournament. It's the World Championships, I guess, or World something they call it. And I don't know how they get away with calling it that because there's only teams from the U.S. there. But I guess that's how it goes. But one thing that's for sure is you definitely see more kids in athletics, and therefore you see more athletic injuries nowadays. So when I was young, and I didn't know this because I didn't have to have, for instance, an anterior cruciate ligament reconstruction surgery, which is a surgery I do relatively often, I didn't know anybody who had to do that. But when you had those, when I was young, 50 years ago, they would open you up with these giant incisions, and they would do all these things. And I you know, I've seen over the years lots of people who have had that, who then later needed knee replacements, and their knees just looked terrible, and they had these great big scars on them. And then right around the late 70s, early 80s, arthroscopy came in. So that's where we put the cameras in. And that changed the whole game for especially the meniscus tears. Meniscus is the cushion in between the end of the femur bone at the knee joint. So the end of the femur and the top of the tibia, that's your knee joint. So there's a couple little semicircular cushions in there called meniscus. And it used to be when your meniscus tore, they would make a big incision, take the whole thing out, because that's all they could do, you know, in the early 70s, let's say, to mid 70s, and then on into the early 80s. And remember that when something comes along like arthroscopy that's really game changing, it takes at least a decade for everybody to be on board with that, because just kind of inside baseball on how it works is, let's say I have a long time left in my career. I'm 55. I feel really good. I really enjoy what I'm doing. I love my practice right now. I love my partner. I know I've talked about all that, but so if something to that magnitude came out, I would learn it. Well, that's what the robot is, right? But let's say I'm 60 and I have 4 or 5 years left. How much do I want to learn a new skill like robotic knee replacement, or back then arthroscopic ACL reconstruction, which is from a technical perspective, the leap from an open to an arthroscopic ACL reconstruction is much more difficult than the leap from a traditional mechanical jig-based total knee to a robotic total knee. That is much easier and smoother of a transition. But if I was 60 when arthroscopic surgery came out and I had been doing it open my whole career, I would have done it open for the rest of my career. I would not have taken the level of training it would have taken, because it would take a lot to go from open to arthroscopic sports medicine. And it would have taken, you know, years to get good at it, and then you're done. So the same thing kind of applies with the robotics. There are some surgeons that are towards the tail end of their career, and if you go to them and you say, hey, here's a robot that is going to make your knee replacements more predictable and have fewer outliers and have overall better patient outcomes, but it's not day and night, but it's definitely better significantly, if that makes sense. So it's not total knee replacements. If you look at the historical data on them, about 80 to 85% of patients are either satisfied or extremely satisfied. When you look at the Mako robot, it's 95%. So that's a big change, right? That's a big change. But if you really drill down into the details of what that means, let's say you're super busy, and this would be super busy, and you do 300 total knees a year, super busy. And somebody comes to you and says, we have this new robot, and it's going to take about 15, maybe 20 extra minutes per case. Maybe you could whittle that down to 10 to 12. Well, immediately on the higher volume side, the surgeon is going to say, well, okay, if I can do 6 total knees in a day, and I only have X number of hours in the OR, and you're adding 15 minutes to each, that's 85 minutes, that's an hour and a half at the end of the day I don't have, because the OR wants me to be done. So I'm doing 1 or 2 fewer knees in that day. That can be a hard sell, and understandably so, especially when you say, well, hey, you know, my patients do just as well as everybody's. And then, of course, all surgeons think their patients do better than they actually do. That's just human nature. So you can see where some of the surgeons who are nearing the end of their careers, regardless of their age, I mean, you probably have some guys in their early 50s that are like, oh, I got 3 more years and I'm out. You know, it all depends on your own personal preference. But you can see why there's not, like, why isn't everybody have a robot? Well, Most of the groups are getting robots. I know a couple of the groups in Des Moines. I think two of the three major groups in Des Moines now have a Mako robot. And like I've said, there's the Mako and then there's everything else. And so I'm just trying to kind of give a picture of why, you know, we're 5 years into our Mako program out here in Carroll. We've done, between Dr. Dirks and I, well, I've done over 500. He's been here. Well, he was doing them over before when he was in Spencer. So he's probably done, you know, 300-400 total joints, maybe more. So we've done knocking on the door of 1,000 robotic joints. And then I've done, you know, maybe 2,000 non-robotic before that. So it's, you know, we have a lot of experience. So we capitalize on that. But if you wonder, well, what's the barrier? Why doesn't everybody have the robot? Well, your smaller hospitals are going to look at the volume and they're going to say, we can't spend $1.5 million on a robot because we're just doing 20, 30 knees a year here. We're never going to make that money back even close, right? We're never going to boost up our business enough. We can't afford it. So that's one thing. Then you have on the surgeon side, well, what would be a barrier to adoption of the Mako? And again, the reason I'm explaining this is because I'm sitting there telling you how great the Mako is, which I've been doing for 5 years now. And people might be wondering, well, 5 years down the road here now, we still don't have a Mako in this setting and that setting. So I'm trying to just set the understanding of why there would be a slower uptake. Now, what I think is going to continue to happen is you're going to continue to have those 10% of patients who are doing better with the robot, or 10 or 15% of the patients who are doing significantly better with the robot than they would have otherwise. And I think that that's going to continue to drive patient expectations. And people, I think, when they look around and a surgeon saying, hey, I get great results without the Mako. I've been doing it this way for 25 years. 100%. That's 100% true. And 80 to 85% is good stats. 85 to 95% is a change, but it's not, you know, it's not going from 30 to 95%, right? That's what we would say is marginal change. So it's a change at the margins. You're going to have a fair number of patients who are doing better, but it's not going to be like a day and night, you know. So yeah, just kind of reflecting on the Mako and what it means to be able to have it and how thankful I am to have it and how different it's been for my patients before we got the Mako and now after we got the Mako. And then just try to answer some of those questions that I'm sure pop into people's heads, like, well, why doesn't my local hospital have a Mako? Why doesn't my surgeon want to use a Mako? And every hospital makes their own decisions. I'm just giving you a framework for, you know, kind of my thought process of why some people would be reluctant. I mean, again, if I was, let's say I'm 18 months from retiring, I'm not learning the Mako. I don't know how many years I would need to have left. If I was, you know, I'm 55, I still think I've got 10 full-time years and maybe 5 part-time years left. I'll probably work till I'm 70. I mean, I like what I do. You know, what are you going to do with all your time, really? I mean, I have a lot of things I enjoy doing, but of the top things I enjoy doing, taking care of patients is right up there. And, you know, of course, there's the stress of it and the physical taxation of it, and those things are going to get more important as I get older. But really, this, if you look at most orthopedic surgeons retire around 65. So, you know, I'm kind of right in that spot of the last 10 of a 30-year full-time career. And so if I was closer, though, if the Mako robot had come out and I was 61 and I was retiring at 65, there's no way I would have learned it. So just a little Mako perspective, a little bit of kind of inside baseball on how decisions might be made. And look, a non-robotic knee is still an excellent operation. Again, 80 to 85% historically of good to excellent results. And then you have fair results. So it's not like those other 15 are super unhappy, but you know, some of them certainly will be, but that's true regardless over time. I mean, there's going to be some issues there. It's not a perfect operation. Bodies aren't perfect. Bodies don't react to it perfectly, but that's just a little bit of my perspective on why things take a while to really get full uptake in medicine. And yeah, so I hope everybody's enjoying the spring, and Easter is around the corner. It's a wonderful time for gratitude and renewed hope, whether you are a Christian or not. So I hope everybody is enjoying all of these things, and you have a blessed week, Iowa.
This has been the St. Anthony Hospital Orthopedic Show with Dr. Richard Godding. For more information about Dr. Godding, his practice, or St. Anthony Hospital Orthopedics, go to www.stanthonyhospital.org or make an appointment by calling 712-794-5536.